welcome everyone joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. I am Roy, AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Jason, WF2N, will be your co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages. We also offer original articles and reviews on many topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club website. The link can be found on the front page of our website in orange-colored type, but if you would like a simple URL to find it, you can just type puzzle.kc2rc.com into your browser. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just tell anyone that they can point their browser to stream.kc2rc.com and receive an audio stream of this repeater. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month. All of this information can also be found on our club website, www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club, and as always, an application is readily available on our website. No question is too simple, no question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight, as always, will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your name, your call sign, and whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try to provide a cogent answer, and Jason, WF2N, will join in as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment, and when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know either here or use our email address, which is tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, Jason WF2N. Good evening, Jason.
This is the KC2RC repeater. Please use PL88.5.
Greetings, Roy. This is WF2N. Good evening, everyone listening.
I heard a rather noisy signal a few minutes ago. I hope whoever that was is moving his antenna to a better location so that we have something closer to full quieting so we can understand them. But nevertheless, if anyone has any questions or statements or topics for the technical net tonight, please feel free. Hit the push-to-talk button, give me your first name and your call sign, and whether you have a comment or a question.
Yeah, first James, 82 TFJ. I'm not sure if my location is better or not. I've been a while ago, I did come over the air. I had a question, and hopefully y'all can actually can hear me better.
It's about 50% noise, 50% signal. What's your first name, sir?
Got Christian, 82 TFJ. I'm moving here in Brownsville, Brooklyn.
Good. We'll put you on the list, so we'll ask if anyone else out there has any questions tonight or topics or comments for the technical net tonight. Please hit the push-to-talk button and give us your first name and your call sign.
This is Bob, KD2NVB. I have an interesting little radio curiosity question, and I don't know if you're doing this or not. I also could have a virus question. It's up to you. So put me on the list. Thanks, Roy.
Bob, yeah, we will take any question tonight. It depends upon what people want to hear. Some places people want to talk about it. Some places they don't want to talk about it. So it's up to you guys. Anyone else want to put their name down for tonight for any kind of technical question or topic or comment?
2GS. 4 Echo Sierra Uniform, Glenn in Bay Ridge. Good evening, Roy.
Good evening, Glenn. Do you have a question tonight?
It's going to do with my RFI issue on 10 meters and whether you guys are familiar with Polymer Engineers who provide kits for RFI.
Right?
Again?
It's Palomar, right? P-A-L-O-M-A-R?
Roger, roger.
It's fine. We'll put you on the list and we'll talk about it. No problem at all. Anyone else want to put their name on the list tonight? Or any questions of a technical nature? Or topics? Or a comment? Okay, very well. Christian, you're up first. Can you repeat your call sign once or twice for me? Because I don't think I got it completely correct.
Got Kilo Delta 2, Tango Foxtrot Juliet. Christian, you got that right.
Good, Christian. So what's your question tonight?
I also have some information as well for the other stations. I work with the American Red Cross, so I had some information for the virus if goes deep. I'm open to answering that question if necessary. My question is, I actually have a few questions. One, I just got, I'm just using the radio now. I'm using my Anytone AT778. And I wanted to know what would be a good antenna for it. I'm using I forgot the name of this antenna. It's one of these sneaky little antennas that I got off of Amazon. But if anybody has a good idea of what antenna to use, I'm going to be using it as a base station and also in my vehicle. I just wanted to know if anybody has an idea of what a good antenna would be and the price ranges for it.
Christian. I assume the gist of it is, because there's a little bit of noise in the background, you're looking for something that would work well in a car, but also that you could use in your base station. Is that the gist?
Yeah, roger, that's roger. I'm guessing the noise is because of where I'm at. I'm using the antenna outside my window. I'm more like the third floor of my building, so I'm guessing the noise is. I am also very close to a cell phone tower. It's actually on my building as well. So I'm guessing that's where the interference is coming from.
Christian, well, as far as a decent antenna that would work reasonably well both as a car-mounted one and as a base station, I would assume you're pretty much looking for a magnetic mount device. What magnetic mounts are basically verticals where the car is bonded by a magnet, and a capacitor is designed into it so that it uses the car as a ground radial, if you will. So with magnetic mounted verticals, you need to have some metallic object. That's why when you put it in your car and you can just pop it on the car and off the car, you might scratch the paint. So it depends upon how bad that would be for you. But that's a good idea because it's very easy to just pop it out, take it into your house. But the problem with that is that you're going to need to put it on something that has a significant amount of ferrous iron-like material so that it sticks to it and couples to it, and it uses it as a ground radial. Now, I tell some people, you know, if you absolutely positively can't mount it on the outside, some people put it on top of their refrigerator. So a refrigerator certainly is a big metallic object, so it works for a lot of people that way. If you have an indoor-outdoor type of air conditioner, you know, where most of it is jutting outside of your house, and you stick the magnetic mount onto that surface on the outside and run the cable in through a window, that could be very useful too. The problem with UHF-VHF is it's important to get it as high as you can and away from nearby obstruction. So you would get incredibly better results even for the same magnetic mount with a smaller piece of metal at the base of it, the higher you're able to get it, you know, the roof being the best place. As far as brand names, Diamond and Comet both make excellent antennas. They have a whole series of magnetic mounts available. They're slightly different lengths. Some of them are primarily only for 2 meters and 70 centimeters. Others have a tri-band characteristic, so it sort of depends upon what you want to use it for in the long run. But a good 2 meter, 70 centimeter Diamond or Comet magnetic mount probably would suit you at this point in time. So I'll just throw it out to the audience, and if anyone else has any opinions that they would like to share, please do.
NVB.
Yes, Bob.
Boy, and Christian, that's exactly what I've got. I've got a, I believe it's Diamond. If it's not, it's Comet. And actually, Roy helped me make this decision about 3 years ago. It's just a quarter wave mag mount, and I have it indoors. I'm on a third story apartment, and I happen to have a metal, like, record, like old LP records. It's a big cabinet, in other words. It's a metal cabinet, and the antenna is on this cabinet that's about, 7 feet high off of my floor. So it's maybe, 25, 28 feet off the ground. And it's inside, but it's near the window. And it works quite well. I use it, even put my HT through it, and I can hit some repeaters fairly far away. So it'll be even better outdoors, but I don't have an outdoors. I don't even have an air conditioner in the window or in a fire escape. So I'm just throwing that out there. I went to EHAM, because I knew what type of thing I was looking for. I think it is Diamond, but it was the one of that description, a quarter wave mag mount. It's at they're $30 or $40. And I went to the one that had the most people, the highest rating, kind of combination. And it was like a bunch of people rating it, somewhere around 4.6, 4.7. So you could check that, but I'm pretty sure it was the Diamond. So that's what I have. Back to Ned.
Thanks, Bob. Anyone else with any opinions on the subject, please feel free.
For issue. Just mentioned that was my setup for 10 years, a magnetic mount on a cookie sheet on the roof of my two-story house in Bay Ridge. And for over 10 years, that's what I used as a UHF, VHF antenna before I finally broke down and bought a proper antenna. Back to you. It worked great.
Very good, Glenn. I'm glad to hear that. So we kind of all came to the same conclusion. Unless there's someone else out there who has something to say, I'll throw it back to Christian and ask him if he feels that he's gotten his question answered. And if not, ask it again whatever way you want.
Yeah, I got it. That sounds about as good as it gets, actually. I was thinking about using the mag mount a lot because it works for my car and in the house. So yeah, that's why I went along with getting a mag mount and thank you guys for answering that question.
Very good, Christian. And we're here every second and fourth Wednesdays of the month. If you have any questions down the road, please feel free to share them with us. Next up is Bob, KD2NBB. What's your question tonight, Bob? Or you had a story to tell? I'm not quite sure.
Hi, Roy. Hi, Ned. This is everybody on the net. Excuse me, I just finished eating. I had a question and maybe another question about the virus, but first about the radio. It was just a curiosity question. I have very little HF experience because I just don't have a situation where I can set up an antenna, or I haven't figured it out yet. But I do have a little portable shortwave receiver that does sideband, and I've gone out and I've listened to HF, and I notice when you tune, how the voices go higher and lower. They sound like you breathe helium if it's on the high end, or you breathe freon if it's on the low end. but I notice it's different, like upper and lower sideband. Of course, what is the thing? I don't have enough experience to really know this for sure. Is it when you get closer to the center of the band that it's getting higher or it's getting lower? Because I noticed on one that you go down and it goes up, the pitch goes up, and then the other, if it's the other sideband, it goes, it's the opposite. So I was just wondering if you could just quickly describe that. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, sure, Bob. Well, basically, you have to kind of understand what upper sideband and lower sidebands are. In the beginning, there was amplitude modulation. You took a carrier frequency at a given frequency, and you superimposed, modulated, a audio waveform on top of that. What that effectively does is it breaks one RF transmission into really three. In the center is your remaining carrier frequency. The most it gives you is a reference point. It doesn't waver, it doesn't change, and it doesn't offer any other information other than what the carrier frequency you used is. On either side are things called sidebands, which are the sum and difference of the audio frequency on the carrier's RF frequency. So you'll get an upper sideband and you'll get a lower sideband. Well, some clever person realized that more than 50% of the energy is going into the non-informational carrier wave. The beauty of having a carrier wave is that what happens is when you're tuning into an AM signal, as you well know, when you're off frequency, it sounds normal, but the audio is low. And as you bring it up to the center frequency, you're getting the peak of the transmission and the amplitude of the audio signal that you're listening to becomes clearer. That's the only benefit that has. If you were to separate the carrier wave and throw it away, and then take one of the sidebands, either the upper or the lower sidebands, and throw that away, you would save a great deal of energy efficiency because you could pack more information per watt into either the upper sideband or the lower sideband. The problem is that without a carrier wave, you can't really understand what's going on. So you have to introduce a beat frequency, an internal reference on your radio receiver that bumps against the sideband and demodulates it to an audio signal that you can recognize. Depending upon whether it's an upper sideband in the 20 meters and above or lower sideband in below, 40 and 80 and 160, shifting the frequency on your receiver shifts the carrier wave, and in half of the cases it brings the audio frequency seemingly up, and the other it brings it down. It's just a factor of whether you're operating upper sideband or lower sideband. That's all. So that's kind of like why you have that helium. If your beat frequency is not correct and the sum and differences are shifted to a higher frequency, you're hearing these high-pitched helium voices coming at you. So does that explain it, Bob?
Right. Yeah, I basically knew all that, of course, those basic things, but, and if it's lower sideband, it's just, I'm trying to remember which sideband does it which way is kind of what my question was. I guess it makes, like when I say going towards where the carrier would be if there was a carrier, is that the way that makes it either go down or up in pitch? And that would be going up from a lower, and we'd be going down from an upper, and going away from where the carrier would be if you'd left it in. That's going to make it, it does it one way on the upper, one way on the lower. I was just wondering which way it was, because I don't know why I couldn't just quite figure it out when I was sitting there tootling the radio, but I had trouble doing that. Back to you, if that makes any sense to you.
Makes sense to me. It has to do with where the sideband is in relation to the carrier's, where the phantom carrier that you're injecting it into is. So in upper sideband, in 10 meters, say, in upper sideband, you're throwing away the lower frequency sideband in the carrier, and you're simply using the upper sideband, the higher frequency of the three signals that amplitude modulation produce. And if I remember right, and I may get it wrong, when you're hearing a high-pitched tune coming out of a person's voice, it's because you've set the carrier frequency too high. And when you hear the voice going baritone, it's because you set the frequency a little too low. It flips over in the opposite direction for the lower bands when you're operating lower sideband.
Okay, so that means it goes lower when it's going closer to where the carrier would be, and because that would be going down on an upper sideband, it'd be going up on a lower sideband. And when it's going away from where the carrier would be if you left it in, it's going down in frequency, whether it's up on the upper sideband or down on a lower sideband. If I got that correct, is that what you were saying?
If you're exactly at the frequency of the original carrier wave, then you're on pitch. So it's not in relationship to the upper sideband frequency or the lower sideband frequency per se, but it's in relation to the middle where the carrier was originally and then removed. So with say 10 meters, if you're operating 28.380, you know, and plus a 100 cycles up, everyone will sound as though they're 100 cycles higher in pitch. But that's the frequency that you're setting for the imaginary carrier. You're not really, the frequency that you set on your radio is not really the frequency of the upper sideband. It's the frequency of where the carrier would have been.
Except when you do it, if you had lower side, just pretend for a minute, or you just change the frequency. Pretend you're doing lower sideband on 10 meters, which I guess you can't do, but people just don't. It would be the opposite. Because I noticed that when it's lower sideband, it's the opposite direction that makes the pitch go either up or down than it is from the upper sideband.
Bob, because now you're throwing away the upper sideband and you're receiving the lower sideband on the other side of the carrier. So it works the exact opposite way. Glenn wanted to say something, though.
No, it wasn't me, Roy.
It was me. What's going on, guys?
Something. I heard someone. I misidentified them, I guess.
Sorry, that would be me, Roy. AC2AE.
Hey, Joe. What do you want to say?
I wanted to just let you know, one, that I was in here. I have been listening. And in the meantime, while I was listening, I looked up a nice little chart of how the carrier wave and the upper sideband and the lower sideband portion are represented on this graph. So I actually sent a copy of it to Bob, and I also sent, I saved the picture onto Facebook, Kings County Radio Club's page, for anybody who was listening out there.
Very good, Joe. I've actually written articles on that subject. It's been at the back of the monthly minutes. I don't exactly know what month it was and where to go looking for it, and one of these days I have to put up all these articles in another form on the web pages. But yeah, there's lots of material on upper and lower sideband, and it's an interesting problem with a single sideband. It caused a lot of people to be very nasty about single sideband back in the 50s when it was a brand new thing, because the balanced modulator design was not something that popped into everyone's mind a long, long time ago. Around the 40s, they came up with the balanced modulator necessary for, not too expensive single sideband. And the AM people just had a conniption fit because it wasn't as beautiful and silky as amplitude modulation, and they call people Donald Duck and all kinds of things. So it's been noticed since the onset of single sideband technology. Yes, Bob. So did we hopefully answer your question or give you a good idea of where to look it up or something?
That's exactly what I was saying. Yeah, you confirmed what I was saying, which I kind of thought before, but I got a little confused when I was actually playing with the radio. I figured it was like the intuitive way on upper sideband, like go up and it goes up, and the opposite on lower. So that confirms my original theory, guess. So it's interesting, that's all. So, and thank you, Joe, for, I will look for that graph or whatever it is you sent me. It probably has more information than that, too. So thanks, everybody. And, I also had a virus question if you want to do that, Roy. So it's up to you. Back to you.
Sure, Bob, you can do a virus question. And Christian, I appreciate any input you want to give us. I happen to be a practicing physician for the last 40 years, so I have a little bit of experience. But if you have something else that you need to, that you think is a good new information, please feel free. So, Bob, what's the question?
Roy, this is, by the way, you know, these questions, I'm sure I'm not the only one. These little questions pop up all the time, the devil in the details about, you know, clean this and do that. I just took my laundry. You know, I unfortunately have to use a laundromat. I don't have a machine, and my building doesn't have a machine, so I have to take those risks. And the ladies are very nice at the place I've always gone before to do my own laundry. And there are only two ladies there, and they're standing far apart most of the time. But I did notice they're not using gloves, they're not wearing masks, and you know, they did all my laundry. Should I worry? I just don't know the amount of time, like maybe nobody knows, the amount of time it stays on fabric. Like if they happen to have a germ on their hands. I guess even if they did wear gloves, they'd have to change the gloves very frequently for it to be any much different than if they're not wearing gloves. So to be safe, I might leave them overnight before I use the stuff. So I don't know if you have any input on that or any more information than I already know about that. So that's it. Back to you, Roy.
AC2GS. Well, yeah, it's a good question, and unfortunately there's only kind of sketchy answers at this point. People have done experiments on the half-life of viral particles on different surfaces, and they've come to the conclusion that absorbent material it doesn't really like to be on absorbent material, although cardboard, they say, it can be viable for as long as 12 hours, so go figure that. Copper is—it's particularly not happy with. It kind of fades away by 4 hours just sitting on copper. Stainless steel, unfortunately, it likes for a couple of days, and as well as some plastics. The way I would kind of judge it is sort of what you do. And I do this even with cardboard boxes and such. When I get a shipment of something, I bring it in, put it over to the side, wash my hands, and leave it in that little area of the floor for a day or so, and then I open it up. It's probably overkill, but I think overkill is a good idea.
K2NVB, yeah, that's exactly what I do too. Actually, I heard you say that on another net. I think that's what gave me the idea. I just did that about an hour ago. Stuff I got yesterday. I ordered some vitamins, and I, you know, did all that stuff. And again, like they say, put your gloves on every time. That's sort of another question. Put your gloves on every time when you like clean these things or do that, and then throw them away, and then wash your hands. Well, I already went through. I don't want to use my gloves too fast, so that I just didn't use gloves. And then I did. I can't decide. I'm going to wash my hands anyway. And another thing, I guess this is another question, then I'll stop at that. But I've been throwing some of these gloves in a bag, because if I run out of gloves, I wonder if it's safe to reuse gloves if you waited, whatever, several days or whatever. I haven't heard anybody address that one.
Well,
Unfortunately, there are some hospitals that are so badly staffed and supplied that they're reusing all kinds of things. They're basically washing them in some alcohol and reusing them again, which I guess you could theoretically do. For a lot of cases, I think the rubber gloves are on a theoretical basis kind of overkill. You're not going to catch the virus through your hands. What happens is you track the virus, you pick it up with your hands, and then you scratch your face and touch your mouth and rub your nose and rub your eyes, and it's all these mucous membranes where the virus latches on and grows quickly. So as long as you can keep yourself from not touching your face with your hands, I don't really see a practical need for the gloves except as a mnemonic to remind you not to touch your face. You know, if you touch something that might have a viral particles on it and you don't touch anything else and you go in and you wash your hands for 20 seconds, soapy water, 20 seconds, that's enough to break up the viral particles. The coat of the virus is basically a glorified soap bubble. It's a fatty oil, and so soap will dissolve the virus if you give it 20 seconds exposure. That should be sufficient, I think. But you know, if you want a suit and belt and suspenders, you know, and want to use the gloves, if you run out, theoretically, if you kind of rinse them off with a little alcohol, they should be fine as far as the viral particles are concerned.
Just sat around for several days. Would it naturally be safe without you doing that? I'm just curious.
Theoretically, yes. How long it might take, given different types of the plastics that that gloves are made of, I couldn't exactly tell you. But most likely, if you just left them out for X number of for a day or two or three. If you want to be real obsessive compulsive, if you have a UV light anywhere around, you might want to kind of shine it at that. UV light also breaks it down. Heat breaks it down. There's a whole bunch of wonderful fun things that break this virus down. But we don't have hard numbers yet. I mean, we have preliminary numbers, but I'm sure they're going to be subject to change.
Throw them in a bag, which I've just done this. I've just started doing this. Maybe they need to be out in the air. Is there a difference between being in a, like in a bag, or being hanging over something? Trying to keep old stuff that's been used because of the shortage.
you get that? I have a few statements to make after your response.
Actually, I didn't really. I mean, I've got this being recorded. It's just the signal is so noisy that I am recording this. You know, my 7100 does that, so I could play it back and really try to listen to it. Unfortunately, it sounds like he's saying a lot of interesting, good stuff, but his signal is so bad. I don't know about how it is on your end. Okay, back to you. I was just wondering if it mattered when you threw it in a bag, which would be like easy to isolate it from me, as opposed to hanging it over things. I don't really have too many things to hang it over.
Control, W5TV. Well, this is Daniel, W5TAB. I have a follow-up question on that last question. I'm currently spraying the packages that I received with Lysol. Then I'm leaving them there for a few hours and then rubbing whatever's inside with Clorox wipes. Is that being overkilled, or will this type of product actually work?
To a degree, it's overkill, but I have no problem, as I said, with overkill. And Lysol should be effective. You know, every little bit kind of helps. Most likely, these things do not have that much of a lifespan, so that being kicked around with UPS, the most probably dangerous aspect of a cardboard box is if your UPS driver coughed or sneezed right before he put it down on your porch or whatever. You can spray it. I just like to put it off to the side in a kind of a humid environment for a day or so. I figure that covers our bets. But you know, if you want to double and triple your chances with the measures that you put in, that's fine. Before I get back to you, Daniel, I just want to say a couple of things that what Christian said. And unfortunately, as Bob mentioned, you were about 80% noise. I do know a bit about the coronavirus. Again, I've been a practicing physician for over 40 years. Coronaviruses are not the common cold. The common cold, there's rotaviruses, there's a bunch of different viruses, influenza, especially during the winter time. Coronavirus is a somewhat esoteric type of a viral infection for human beings. It's primarily known in the animal kingdom. Wild animals, bats, and others have different forms of coronaviruses that infect them to a degree. There have been times where the coronavirus mutated. The first was SARS in 2002-2003. The second was MERS. That was a coronavirus that mutated. Both SARS and MERS have a higher mortality rate, but a much lower infection rate. So they didn't really wreak havoc the way that the coronavirus, COVID-19, is doing, because it's highly infectious. And although its mortality rate is less than SARS, if it infects millions of people, and it's only, quote, only 2%, that's a lot of people. So it's not that coronaviruses have this type of coronavirus has been around forever, and we don't really know. It probably mutated in Wuhan, China, somewhere between November and December in a wet market that had bats and snakes and other such things, and then spread from Wuhan through international travelers and all over the world. So I just wanted to point out that coronavirus is not the same as the common cold. The common cold has a negligible mortality rate. Influenza has a 0.1% mortality rate. Some people believe that the coronavirus that we're suffering, the COVID-19, has approximately a 2% mortality rate. But that's subject to change as the statistics get calculated. But that's the kind of the short form of what coronavirus is.
Expertise, Roy. This is Daniel, W5TAB. Thank you.
I'm glad that I can make people hopefully understand what's going on. I don't want anyone to panic, because panic just leads to irrational actions that that are counterproductive, if anything. But I don't want people to go around denying and saying that it's just like influenza. Again, I wish it was like influenza, because then it would be probably 20 times less fatal. But right now it doesn't seem to be. We'll see. Glenn, N4ESU, you had a question tonight?
Roy, just trying to solve my RFI issue on 10 meters. I did create what is commonly called an ugly ballon with about 15 wraps around the 4-inch PVC pipe near the antenna feed point. It didn't seem to correct it, so now I'm looking at a kit from Polymer Engineers that is designed for a specific model of radio I have that has basically 8 different ferret filters, and I'm wondering if you have any experience with either their products, or am I going in the right direction?
Ferrite is a good idea, as I think we mentioned earlier, that you know sometimes it's just not common mode reflection coming back from your antenna. Sometimes there are bits and pieces of your equipment around your shack that are not as well shielded as they should be. And so you then have to deal with, rather than the cause, you have to deal with the result. The source of it, you have to deal with the results of it. And so I guess that these are toroids to wrap around the mic cord. You'll have to explain to me. Palomar is a reasonably well-known company. They're named after, I guess, Mount Palomar there with the telescope. I've bought ferrites from them. They're good quality. That's kind of all that I've ever bought from Palomar, was just bunches of different ferrites to use for different situations. I made a instead of a, it's quite, not quite the same as the ugly ballon, which is the loops of coaxial cable. There's another type that's very, very similar, W2DU, named after the guy who promoted it. It was something like 6 thick ferrite clamps, one after the other on the coax, leading close to the antenna feed. And then I threw a heat shrink glue tubing around it and sealed it up so that it was nice and weather tight. Different things work. And I got those from Palomar. They were good.
This looks like 3 rings for DC power, the 2 antenna cables, and then they give you like 5 snap-ons for various other input and output cables. I guess you could throw one on the microphone. Doesn't say anything specifically about the microphone, but okay, thanks very much. I appreciate the advice and the information. Back to you.
John, with a comment?
Hi.
Just wanted to add, you just want to be sure to get ferrite around any of the cables running into your transceiver. And once you've done that, you probably, if you're still getting the noise, then as Roy said, you want to look at the source. And you can do that with, some people buy these handheld shortwave radios, and you can tune around and see if you can locate the source of it, and then hopefully, wrap any of the offending cables there around the toroid ferrite, or however you say it. That's all I wanted to say. This is WF2N, back to Matt.
Jason, I agree completely with Jason. The point of this kit, I would think, is simply to have a RF choke on every part of your transmitter. Because obviously what's going on is the transmitter itself. Well, there's one of two things. Either the transmitter is clean and it's feeding the signal up the antenna transmission line, getting reflected into common mode, coming down and spraying it all around, which is unlikely because you've already tried the ballon and it had no effect. So most likely what's going on is around the wiring of your transmitter, there's leakage of the RF into other wires. So you sort of want to RF choke every wire that's connected to that transmitter to kind of block its exit from your transmitter box into the surrounding environment that then is going to go around and reach your RF preamp, your mic preamp, and produce that strange audio noise that distorts the transmission.
So looking at a product from MFJ called an artificial ground. It's something you attach to the transceiver and then you run basically a counterpoise wire around the perimeter of the room. Anybody have any experience with that?
Alpha Charlie 2 Alpha Echo.
And then Joe, so Jason first.
I don't have direct experience with that product, but I just wanted to say that you'll probably save some money if you just get a copper strap, or I've got one inch copper pipe that I bought at Home Depot. I've mounted that under my desk, and I run copper strap from my transceiver to the copper pipe, also from my amplifier. Basically, any electronics that I have here are grounded to that, and then I ground. I make sure that copper pipe is then connected to the ground rod at my service panel.
Wanted to say something on the artificial ground from MFJ.
I did. I had one a few years ago because, as some of you guys know, I'm in an apartment, and I've got issues with the ground. So, basically, I had it, and I saw no difference whatsoever in it. It was basically, I think I paid like $140 or $150 for the unit, and it really didn't do anything, and I winded up selling it a few months later.
Joe, I sort of agree with you. Really what that thing is a variable counterpoise. I don't remember exactly what your antenna is like. I assume it's either balanced or already has a counterpoise. I could understand some people might think that it's a decent excuse for a ground. It's really not a ground. It doesn't serve the same purpose as a ground. Like I said, it's primarily a tunable counterpoise, so that if you don't have a counterpoise on your proper antenna, and you don't have enough room to stick a piece of wire that's the appropriate length, this is kind of a short wire with a capacitor and inductor tuned circuit inside that you can adjust in order to resonate as a counterpoise for a given frequency, but then you have to keep on changing it depending upon if you change bands and such. I've seen it. I've heard people who've had it. A few people find it useful. A lot of people don't. Your mileage might vary. But if you do have a counterpoise on your antenna or it's a balanced antenna, I don't think it really brings anything special to the party.
And I have an off-center fed dipole that I use. And again, I'm on the second story of my house, so I don't have a proper ground, which was something we discussed early on when I first joined the club at one of the first technical nets that we had. Thank you very much, guys. I appreciate it. N4 ESU, back to net control.
Ben, anytime. Joe, I'm not quite sure. I imagine you just checked in to tell us that you were here, but I'll ask if you had any questions tonight.
I am all questioned out tonight, man. I am just here to support the net for you.
Very good, and I appreciate that, Joe. I will ask if there's anyone else out there who has any technical questions or any comments that they'd like to make. Give me your first name and your call sign.
KD2HUH.
How are you? You just want to say hello, or you have any questions, or you have any comments on something that we were talking about?
Radio Roy, good evening. I heard Joe. Good evening, Joe. No, I got a question and a head scratcher that I always with a head scratcher, but yeah, I guess you could consider it a question to you. Might as well do it here in the net, and because here I am.
To us.
The quarter wave vertical I have in my attic. It's one of these diamond 3 foot, 4 foot long antennas in the attic. But anyway, on the scanner for the past, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks, line mark sounds distorted to me on the scanner. And tonight I said, this is ridiculous, and I just checked all the other, there's a lot of activity on, and no other frequency sounds distorted, only line mark. I said, okay, that's odd. So then I took the connector off, put it on my Kenwood, the dual bander in the kitchen there, and it's a little distorted. Not as bad as the scanner, but I still hear a little distortion. So I said, interesting. I don't know how an antenna or a coax, maybe it's picking up some kind of interference or something. But anyway, on my base radios, and a completely different antenna, I don't hear any interference or noise or distortion on the signal. So I'm wondering what the heck is going on with the two radios in the kitchen. And even though the signal may show S9 on S9 to 10 dB over on the Kenwood dual band, that should be strong enough for a good sounding signal, but I'm still hearing a little distortion only on those two radios. What do you think?
Chance it might be some form of multipath distortion?
But it's two different receivers, of course, the scanner and the ham radio. And, you know, the antenna is not far from my other antennas, so nothing else seems to be picking it up. Very odd. And as you know what? It could be a type of image or that, because on another frequency I noticed I'm getting a carrier. Yeah, I'm actually getting a carrier on a VH portion of, I don't have the frequency in mind because I'll have to tune around and find it. But very interesting, it could actually be something in the neighborhood that's causing that. But it doesn't happen on any of my other base radios. I have numerous base radios here and a different antenna, and nothing's picking that up.
All I can share with you is LimeWalk works in mysterious ways, in many ways. I was having a problem when I was trying to do my Sunday night TechNet there, and I had to boost my power. Usually about 3 watts will get me into LimeWalk's Glen Oak repeater without any problem. I had to push it all the way to about 38 watts. And so I've been, playing around with antennas. I have, my main antenna is a GP6 that's on above my roof, and I have a backup GP3, which is about half the size, a little bit less gain, that's put up on a top of one of those laundry pole devices for drying your clothes back in the old days. So I tried A and B antenna switching between the two. And on UHF, I got about 3 decibels of gain going from the laundry pole GP3 to the bigger GP6 that I usually have or working for me for my flex, which made sense. On VHF, other frequencies, I got the same plus 3 dB gain. But when I tried it on LimeWalk, it went down 10 dB. So I'm just as confused as that as you might be of this. I'm thinking maybe some weird directionality. Maybe the radials are a little distorted and the lobe isn't quite catching LIMARC or something, but it seems rather weird that it's only LIMARC that's doing that. I'm using very little power tonight on our repeater, and my antenna is working fine for us, but for LIMARC, I had to boost it all the way to 38 watts.
And what do I have? The Diamond X30 is the antenna, so it might be a lot like your GP3, I think. Oh, this is about a 4 foot long antenna. Vertical gain. Anyway, LIMARC is extra weak as it's been for a while, so I guess that's what it is. Although the much larger, longer antenna, higher gain antenna, which is higher also on a couple of radios in the shack, don't seem to be affected by that. So anyway, very good. I guess I'll just have to live with that. LIMARC is the only distorted repeater on my scanner or radio that sounds actually distorted. And yeah, I listened to about 4 or 5 to other repeaters, and they all sound fine on the scanner, so it's definitely not anything wrong with the radio. Okay, very good. I have some equipment I could use to actually analyze it, but I don't even want to be bothered. It's not that important. Very good, Roy. Anything else going on? N2HUH.
Much. I mean, I put CDL on the case. He almost always, when he's listening to LIMARC, has his device that monitors everything and checks everything. And he seems to think, at least from his location, the signal is as good as he expects it to be. I actually emailed him videos of my PAN adapter where the signal strength will fluctuate as much as 10 dBs in 24 hours, which I don't really think is just propagation, especially when I'm talking about a GP6 that's something like 60 feet off the ground. But, you know, I don't know. You know, LIMARC's repeaters are in a state of flux. They haven't really finished locking down the voter system or tweaking a bunch of things. One of the guys just changed some of the wiring to their duplexer. Thought that they were going to get rid of all the static, but I still hear the static, so I don't know. It's a thankless job maintaining a repeater, as Joe knows very well.
Right, very good, and again, you know my test results that I've gotten on numerous radios, numerous antennas, and they all ain't lying. Very good.
Andy, I wish you luck with LIMARC, as I wish myself luck. You know, I hope next week I don't have to yell into the microphone like I did this week, but that's the vagaries of amateur radio. If it was faultless, if it was easy enough, it would just be a cell phone, I guess. So thanks, Andy, for coming around and giving us this question. I wish I could give you a nice, simple answer that could solve both our problems.
Radio, and I would have asked you to check for that signal that I'm hearing on VHF. Actually, it's on a repeater. That's not used often, but there is a signal out there that I'm receiving on a particular repeater frequency, and what I did was I put the encode and decode on so that I don't have to hear that noise, or just when I'm scanning it doesn't, on my base radio here, it doesn't stop on that whatever that is. And it hasn't always been there, because I've had this repeater punched in for a few years now, and for the first time I'm hearing something, some type of stray signal. So, interesting. All right. I'll get back to you again soon. Take care. This is N2HUH.
Good, Andy. You know, I mean, part of the bands is that people are setting up, I don't even know what to call them. They'll send these beacon signals, perhaps as a joke or something. I mean, my neighbor Joe AC2AE, We have a neighborhood beacon that flashes out Mario.
Yes, yes. I've got, let me see if I've got it. Yeah, on 144.500, which 144.490 is the downlink to the International Space Station. And in this particular frequency, there's a couple of Spanish guys that are speaking on this frequency. And when it's not in use, there's a beacon that comes out every 60 seconds. And I used a CW app on my phone, and it says Mario. I don't know. It's got to be two guys pretty close, and I don't know what they're using, or but I think it's one of those Shorecom repeaters. Alpha Charlie 2 Alpha Echo.
Actually, I received that. But by me, it's very weak. It's a very weak signal, so it's not in this neighborhood. And the frequency that I was talking about is 146.76. 146.76, and with my with the preamp on the TS-2000, it's approximately an S9, and that's not the strongest signal in the world, but it's almost as strong as Limewalk is, so it's strong enough. So it's interesting. I don't know if you guys are hearing it. That would be 14676, and it's always there, 24 hours a day, as far as I know.
I haven't picked it up. Maybe Joe has?
Actually, I haven't.
One of the vagaries. You're never quite sure who the hell is screwing around. Sometimes it's a guy with a license. Sometimes it's not a guy with a license. Sometimes it's just some wallwort or fluorescent light ballast or heavy, refrigeration unit, and all kinds of things. I mean, when things go particularly crazy around my shack, I tend to just blame the subway station because I'm sure they have some interesting electronic devices that generate all kinds of nonsense.
It's very funny that you mentioned that, because on damp, rainy days, I do pick up the, I'm going to sound like an idiot, the guy who drives the train, the conductor. It's either the train communicating with the station, or the station communicating to the train. Because it's only when the trains are either pulling in or pulling out of the station.
I don't think, thankfully, I haven't heard any of that. It's a shame WATDL isn't listening out there, because he did a lot of work with the MTA about their communication system. He probably knows more about it than any other guy with an amateur radio license. But that's curious. Maybe it's just bleeding through, and it's just that it's located as precariously close to your QTH, and the weather just kind of gives it a better ground path or something. Who knows?
I'm starting to think it is, because all the known frequencies for the train yard, I've got Tower A, Tower B. I've set them up on a few different HTs so I can listen to them all at the same time, and I never hear them going off simultaneously, or when it makes that noise. So that's it. But I tell you what I do hear also, if I'm down on like 40 or 80 meters, again, when the tracks are wet or damp and a train does come by, and they spark on the tracks, when that blue spark happens, oh, it makes my band jump like crazy.
Shades of the old spark gap transmitter. That's the way the old timers roll.
Those spark gap generators are good, man. Because, I'm sure you get some of the welding too. I'm sure you you've got to get some of that welding too when they're in the daytime. I get all kinds of weird noises.
Really inspect it, you know, or really look that hard around. I mean, I can recall many times where I'm looking at the VHF pan adapter, and I see a peak sliding right and left and wiggling. It practically does a dance. So it's not a transmitter. It's just something that has some kind of oscillations at times that either the primary frequency is on VHF or it's a harmonic, and it just kind of dances around my pan adapter and annoys the hell out of me. And then thankfully it goes, but I've never really been able to figure out where it came from and where it went to. It's just, you know, something I've grown unfortunately used to when I gaze upon my VHF pan adapter every so often.
I often wonder too, I don't know what it is, but when I look at the pan adapter, I see something come from one end of the screen and it slowly goes across, and because the pan adapter, you know, the waterfall moves up, it kind of looks like it's moving in like a diagonal position. Occasionally, it'll move backwards and then, you know, continue going forwards. So I always say to myself, that could be somebody testing their antenna or something like that. You know, I just don't know what it is. But I always wondered. The kid in me and the sci-fi enthusiast wants to think it's media shooting across the sky.
I tend not to think it's someone tuning up, varying the frequency, because, you know, then whatever he's using to as an antenna is going to be non-resonant soon. So my guesstimate has always been that it's some circuit that isn't really meant to oscillate, but it's going into a unstable oscillation, and that's why it doesn't lock into a given frequency, but kind of wiggles around until the oscillations die out and the signal dies with it. That would be my best guess, that it probably is a piece of equipment that doesn't know it's an RF transmitter.
That makes a lot of sense.
My best guess, by the way, AC2GS. Anyone else with any questions or topics for the technical net? Otherwise, we'll go to the puzzle. But if you have any questions or topics, please give me your call sign and your name.
AC2 Zulu Victor.
Zulu Victor.
Alpha Charlie 2, Zulu Victor.
What's your question tonight?
I don't know if you have any recommendations for, like, magnetic antennas for the top of cars for 2 meters.
Well, by the way, you probably would have heard the answer if you tuned in early, because that was one of the first questions that Christian, KD2TFJ, asked us at the very beginning. We're all seemingly fans of either Comet or Diamond. They make a good, general, good quality antennas. They make them in slightly different sizes, slightly different gains. Some are dual band, 2 meters and 70 centimeters. They also sell tri-band versions. My gut feeling is if you're not going to use tri-band, you're better off with just a dual band, assuming that you're going to use both VHF and UHF. But, you know, pretty much anything in Comet and Diamond's inventory are pretty good. I've never heard anyone complain about them as far as quality and workmanship.
Do they come with cables, or do you have to buy those separately?
It depends upon the particular model. I would guess that some of them just come with a connector, and others come with a length of coaxial. The one that I have, I think it's from Comet, came with a built-in coaxial. So most likely, most of them are going to do something like that. If you need to, you can always use an extension cable. but that way it's a little bit more weatherproof since they're designed for outdoor use.
That's great. I'll get one with a built-in cable, and then I'll get extensions. Thanks a lot.
Let us know how it turned out. And of course, as we've mentioned before, and as you no doubt know, with magnetic mounts, you need to place it on a ferrous surface so that it will capacitively couple and use the ferrous surface as a ground plane, because it's designed for a ground plane. So if you don't do that, then it really is not a very efficient, useful antenna. But once you put a nice chunk of metal, it works rather nicely.
That it's going to work better stuck onto the air conditioner cover in the street than it's sitting around handheld in the apartment.
So, one of my go-to telling people, if they want to put it on the outside, if they have a fire escape, or if not a fire escape, if they have an air conditioner that's jutting outside of their apartment, that's a very nice place to stick the magnet. And if people are stuck and there's absolutely nothing that they can do about mounting it on the outside, I tell them to give the refrigerator a try. It certainly is a nice lump of metal. It's probably not as well located, being usually in the middle of people's apartments, but it's better than nothing. But yeah, the air conditioner cover is going to be a very nice place for it.
Just make sure that that's on the outside of the refrigerator, not the inside.
We have a heating system with copper pipes right there that does provide a decent ground.
I mean, there's lots of possibilities. Some people don't have that many, unfortunately. Just things are not wired up well for the location that they have their shack in. So some of them have to float their ground.
When I grounded the Time Warner cable to the heater system, it really cleared up a lot of interference here.
As long as there's nothing insulating any path from the hot water to the actual ground. With cold water, especially old cold water pipes, it's a more consistent chance of running all the way to ground. Whereas nowadays, people who use Plex use plastic that insulates portions of the plumbing, and sometimes the hot water pipes aren't grounded actually. So, you know, then you have to settle for it just being a big lump of collecting metal, not a true ground. But yeah, if it works, it works.
Heater system that's all solid copper and it's all hooked into the cold water as well as the hot water. I mean, it's all like copper and brass are all tied together with valves and stuff, but the electricity would definitely go directly from wherever the copper is all the way through to the cold water pipe.
But, it's not a given. In your case, it is, but it's you know, most people aren't that terribly aware of how their plumbing goes, unfortunately. So usually when I'm giving people advice, I tend to point them towards the cold water as a better chance. But if you know how everything is hooked up and the hot water is ultimately grounded and it's closer to you to tap into it, then great.
Unfortunately, we've had to work on the house quite a bit. It's a baseboard heating system. Anyway, thanks for the advice, and I'll check this out, and I'll be listening online for the questions, and back to you, Net Control.
William, thanks for participating tonight. Once again, I'll ask people, before I pull out the puzzle for tonight, and it's a dB puzzle, decibel puzzle, as I promised 2 weeks ago. We got into talking about decibels, so I figured I would do another decibel puzzle. So if anyone has any other questions or topics or comments tonight before we get to the puzzle, please give me your call sign and your first name. You wanted to say something?
Thanks. I I just wanted to mention a book that would help maybe answer some questions about grounding. It's called Grounding and Bonding for the Radio Amateur. It's a ARRL publication. It's a pretty thin book. It's a pretty quick read, I think. And it's served me quite well, and they have tons of different, you know, advice for folks that have a shack up on a second story or third story, and, you know, may not have access to the service ground in their, you know, at their QTH. So I'll definitely recommend that.
Very good, Jason. Yeah, I have that book as well. It's a little bit overpriced for the number of pages it has. And some of its more sage advice is giving you the name of other books that you should buy that have more information than it has. But it's an easy read, and it gives you some tips and pointers. Anyone with any comments or questions before I do the puzzle for tonight?
2NVB with a quick question.
Hey, Bob, what's your quick question?
I have some, just getting back to this virus thing just for a minute, I have some Lysol that I've had for several years, maybe two, three, up to 5 years, and unfortunately, everywhere I've looked, it's sold out. So I'm using it, but do you have any idea or opinion? I could not find this on Google, a really satisfactory answer. Is it still effective, even if it's like, say, 5 years old? I don't think it does any harm, so that's my question.
I am unaware of a freshness date on Lysol. Lysol tends to use a lot of phenol components, which are real nasty to viruses and bacteria, and unfortunately also nasty to cats. So anyone out there who has a cat, I would suggest not using Lysol too much. But that's just a throwaway thought. Again, it's probably not as powerful as it was the day that you bought it. Also, a big question is, was it sealed or was it open 7 years ago?
Aerosol can, so I mean, I probably sprayed it once or twice, but I hardly used it. It's virtually full.
I mean, if it still has the gas in it, it kind of gets you away from the thinking in terms of oxidation, because it has inert gas in it so that it doesn't have oxygen. So that's one of the major reasons why things kind of degrade, other than bacterial infection, bacterial overgrowth, which you're not going to get with something like Lysol. So it's probably okay. I mean, you know, if you see a nice new clean bottle on the shelf one of these days, it probably would be good to change up to a fresh bottle. But if that's all you got, I'd still use it. You know, the way you describe it, it doesn't seem to, the seal hasn't been disturbed. So, you know, if it still has its gas charge in it, that speaks a lot for that it's intact inside.
Thanks, Roy. It's possible the gas is not quite as much pressure as it was, but I don't really know. It's sufficient, easily sufficient to get out and do some stuff. So, yeah, thanks, Roy. So, that's it. I'll give it back to you.
Very good, Bob. So let me get to the puzzle for March 25th. The puzzle is on our website. You can type in puzzle.kc2rc.com, or you can go to the front page of our website, and in orange text, there's a link page, and you just click on it, and there it is. And the puzzle is, Jackie suspects that the poor signal report she's getting are due to dampness in her coaxial cable feeding her antenna. She feeds 20 watts into a cable and gets 10 watts into a dummy load at the other end. So the question is, what loss is in her coaxial cable? Is her loss 2 decibels, 3 decibels, 4 decibels, or 6 decibels? So anyone want to play tonight?
B. Seems like the obvious answer is B, 3 dB, unless there's a trick that I'm not catching. So I guess I'm going to go with B, 3 dB.
Right. I try not to do tricks here. I save my tricks for Limark. I just want to get people talking about decibels. And we mentioned about 2 weeks ago during our last episode that decibels are tenths of a bell. A bell is logarithm is log base 10. So in other words, one bell is 10 to the 1. Two bell is 10 to the 2. Three bell would be 10 to the 3rd power. But because bells are too big, we use tenths of a bell, the decibel. So 10 decibels is 10 to the 1st power, or 10 times. So I try to tell people that the best way to look at it is memorize just a few rating numbers. You know, you don't have to memorize a logarithmic table, God forbid. And the only thing you really sort of need is to know that 3 decibels is a ratio of 2 to 1, and 10 decibels is a ratio of 10 to 1. And you can do other things with it, since you, when you multiply ratios, you add the decibels. If you have 2 times ratio times 2 times ratio for a 4 times ratio, that would be adding 3 decibels to 3 other decibels, and that's 6 decibels. So 6 decibels mean quadrupling. And also, if you don't want to get yourself a headache, if you take something like 10 decibels is 10 times, that's the ratio, 10 to 1. If you then divide it by half, that would be 5 to 1. And that would be the same as taking 10 decibels and subtracting 3 decibels, or 7 decibels. So you can pretty much figure out that 7 decibels is 5 times, 6 decibels is 4 times, and 10 decibels is 10 times. And then just know that when you multiply ratios, you add decibel numbers. And you can figure out almost all of the decibel ratings that most examiners will ask you for any FCC exam these days. So you don't even need a calculator. So, Bob, you were quite right. The answer was 3 decibels, which was B in the choice of A, B, C, and D. So thank you very much, Bob. I'll put up a little ditty on decibels after this little net, and want to thank everyone. If anyone has any questions or comments before we close it down for the night, now's the time. Just give me your call sign and your first name.
Alpha 2, Zulu Victor, William.
It's William. What can I do you for?
HDBs to foreign students.
Say again, William. Unfortunately, when you hit the push to talk button, there's a little bit of a delay before the transmitter keys in, so I miss your first few syllables.
I used to teach DBs to foreign students, and I always asked them this question.
Question? The question I just asked, or was it a different question?
Question. And the question is, what is 0 plus 0?
Depends upon your definition. If you're doing 0 dB plus 0 dB, it's not going to be 0.
That's the point. And most people not knowing about dBs say, yeah, 0 plus 0 is 0.
William, in some cases, 0 plus 0 is 0. It depends upon where you're phrasing the question from. Because we were talking about decibels, I kind of immediately saw what you were getting at. But if we hadn't mentioned decibels and just mentioned 0 plus 0 without saying 0 decibel plus 0 decibel, I would probably have generally answered the wrong answer, 0.
After we get all that cleared up and we understand that 0 plus 0 is 3, the next question is, what is 1 plus 1?
And did the people that you were teaching enjoy that, or did they frown at you when you were asking these types of questions?
Basically, basically, it was an introductory course in satellite communications where I had to teach them what DBs were. And they didn't know anything. And this was a quick way of getting everybody up to speed.
I come from the days of slide rules. I'm dating myself, as you also had slide rules, and they were based on logarithms.
I had my slide rules. I had an Essex.
I had relatively inexpensive ones because, they kind of went out of fashion by the time I was in high school, so I couldn't rationalize spending money on expensive ones. I had a standard one, and I had one that I bought especially for chemistry that included a periodic table with a bunch of information on the other end. It was one of those slide rules that was more like a slide rectangle.
Like those things, but the guy down the hall had a K&E, and that was like the ultimate with aluminum and everything.
At that point, I couldn't rationalize it. I mean, I still remember that I invested in a calculator of all things, and I still to this day remember my father being aghast at the amount of money that I saved up to buy something like that. It was a Texas Instrument. It was loads of fun playing with in courses and such.
DB.
Bob.
Comments. I remember my dad buying a Texas Instrument calculator. I first heard of him. Oh, I guess it was when I was in college, which was about 1976 or 75. And I remember it was like $150 or $160, and it probably did maybe less than what a $10 one does now, but we were like, yeah, this thing's really cool. The other thing I wanted to say is, I like an interesting fact. If you go up 1 dB, it's roughly 1.25, because if you go up by getting 9 dB gives you 8 times, and 10 dB gives you 10 times, so thus the relationship between 9 and 10 is 1.25. Anyway, I just threw that out there. Back to you, Roy.
Back in the old days when everyone carried around logarithmic tables, you'd just look up to see what the log of point one is. Mathematics is interesting, but unfortunately logarithmic tables and slide rules and all kinds of fun stuff is historic. You can look up loads of very pretty pictures of them on Google. Nowadays, everyone just types it into a inexpensive calculator. Or if you're not on a budget and you want to buy, heavy-duty Hewlett-Packard reverse Polish notation calculators that are programmable and do all kinds of great things, you could get it probably for the price of that much simpler calculator that your father bought back in the good old days.
Roy, I've got a question.
Is the actual formula for the decibel gate?
I forgot to push the little button. Decibel equals 10 log of the ratio. So in other words, 10 log of 10 would give you 10 decibels. So you would have to look up a logarithmic table in order to do that. You could also think of it in terms of 10 to a certain power. Like 10 to the first power is 10, 10 to the second power is 100, 10 to the third power is 1,000. So instead of that 1, 2, or 3, that power is in decibels divided by 10. So a 10 decibel signal strength gain is 10 to the 10 over 10th power, which is 10 to the first power, which is 10 dBs. I hope that helps. I'm going to try and write it down on the website. The problem with the website is they really don't do scientific notation very well, so I'm going to have to figure out if I can trick it into doing it.
It's basically 10 to the 10th power is basically what it is. So if I get like a number like, say, let's say 10, so 10 is going to be 10. If I get like, let's say, the number, 20 decibels. So now I'm going to do 20 to the 10th power. Is that what it is?
It's still, it's always 10 to the power. The difference is in your case, it would be 10 to the 20th divided by 10th power. So 20 divided by 10 is 2, so it would be 10 to the second power, which is 100.
So then would that make 30 decibels, what, 200? Or is that going to go increase again to the 10th power? And then that's going to make it, what, 10,000?
It's 10 to the, then it would be the 30 divided by 10, which is another way of writing 3. So it's 10 to the third. 10 to the third is 1,000.
Okay, I think I'm getting that now. All right. All right, so 10 to the second would be 100. 10 to the fourth would be 10,000. Am I getting that correct?
Have to remember that that would work for bells. Since we're using smaller units like the decibel, you have to divide whatever decibel number you want by 10. So 40 decibels would be the same as 4 bells, and 10 to the fourth would give you 10,000.
I just found the formula online. All right, very good. Okay, this is what it basically is saying. dB ratio, divide the 10, and then do 10 to the 10 x, well, x would be the exponent, and it's like 10, okay, 10 to the 10th power. Example, dB equals positive 12.5 dB. Divide 12.5 dB by 10, that's 1.25, just like you were saying, and then do 10 to 1.25, okay, which is a 17.18 ratio. All right, I think I can figure this out now.
2GS. Okay, very good, Joe. I was going to put it up on the website, and I'm having problems with exponentials, and I'll try and see if I can trick it. If I can't trick it, I'll go find an illustration and plaster an illustration instead of the actual written text. But I'll come up with something to kind of repeat that. But yeah, you have the equation, and that works. The problem with that, though, is you sort of have to know what 10 to fractions would be. Most of the FCC exams keep it very simple. 3 decibels is 3/10 of a bell, or 10 to 0.3, which isn't exactly 2, but it's very, very close to 2, so it's a rounding type of a thing. So when we say that 3 dB is twice, not exactly twice, but it's real close to twice. So, you know, as long as you keep with products of 3, sums of 3 decibels, 6 decibels, 10 decibels, and on and on and on, it's very simple to figure out. If it's a strange fraction that no one's memorized, then you have to actually look it up or run it through a calculator.
Just one more question and I'll be done. So, x, the exponent, wait, am I grabbing the wrong mic? Hold on. Sorry. So x, the exponent number itself, is always going to be what is the number divided by 10. Is that correct?
Number of decibels divided by 10.
Okay, I've got that. All right, very cool. Thank you, Roy.
Welcome, Joe. And I promise everyone, next month's a puzzle will not be about decibels. We will give it a break for a while.
2NVV.
Yes, Bob.
Joe, yeah, there's a very good article about that in the January issue of QST. It's called Untangling the Decibel Dilemma, page 34 in the January issue. Back to Ned.
Anyone with any further closing statements for the technical net tonight? It went nice long time. I'm very pleased. I like to see activity here. Now apparently I'm doing two technets sometimes a week, so just call me Mr. Technet. Anyway, anyone with any comments or questions or answers or statements before we shut her down for tonight, please give me your call sign and your name. Unfortunately, I can't make out a single word. I mean, the only reason I know it's you is because I kind of get the noise is you tonight. So unfortunately, wherever you put the antenna, if you could put it back to one of the other places that was a little bit better earlier tonight.
Better. Wondering if there's any updates on the coronavirus.
David, we kind of talked about the coronavirus earlier, but there's nothing particularly new. If you watch TV, you read the newspapers. New York has almost half of the infections in the United States. The United States is taking off like a rocket, unfortunately. Louisiana looks like it's going to be the next hot spot for the nation because Mardi Gras was the perfect opportunity for the coronavirus to spread all over the place. So their infection rate is probably the fastest of any community in the United States. And the problem with really knowing how the rest of the country is doing is that despite improvement in testing, there have still been very few tests available. A lot of the tests have taken place in New York State, which is partially why New York State has so many reported cases. But I think as time goes on and the test units are spread out throughout the country, there will be other hot spots that light up. One of the hot spots that are probably going to be soon is going to be southern Florida. It has a really high percentage of the elderly, so that's a very dangerous thing. And it just had spring break, in which a lot of young people who thought that they were immortal probably spread it all over the place. So that would be my guess of the next one after Louisiana. Otherwise, there's nothing else new as far as the virus. It's doing what it is designed to do. It infects people. And the better that we socially isolate, the less it has a chance to do that. It doesn't kind of live on the air. It lives on these little nebulized droplets that we spray when we talk and when we touch our when we cough into our hands and then touch things with our hands, and other people touch those things that we touched and then touch their own faces, then they get it. Or if they stand close enough to an infected person and he sprays you with little droplets, and unfortunately everyone who talks to everyone else close enough kind of shares those little droplets. It's a messy world we live in. So that's all I can probably tell you, unless there's any kind of specific question that you have.
Dr. Roy, I think you covered it. Thank you very much.
I just want to add one little thing.
And we'll kind of do the usual VirusNet next Sunday during the TechNet, during the science talk. I don't even know what to call it anymore, but we'll do it again. We'll do it every week until no one cares, and then we'll stop doing it, I guess. There'll always be that, and if anyone has any questions here, again, more than happy to try as best I can to answer them for you. Once again, if you have any other questions or topics or comments before I shut it down for tonight, please give me your call sign and your name.
Hey, with a comment and, question two.
Bob?
I'm probably not the only one that's heard this. It's on the news. According to Cuomo, there's a little bit of cautious optimism in a way that the growth rate may be slowing down. So supposedly it's looks like it doubled in the last 5 days, and before it was doubling every 2.5 or something like that. So that the measures we're taking with distancing, some evidence, I guess it's not very conclusive, but that
it may be doing some good. So I just wanted to say that. And yeah, then I'll try. I'll let you comment on that. Then I have this other little question.
I mean, I hope that's the case. I think this is more a public relations thing. I think it's going to take another week or so before these strict social guidelines will actually have a significant effect. There's a degree of error in the numbers, again, because you have to factor in the efficiency of the testing. So we had a kind of a full upsweep when they instituted kind of generalized testing, where we were picking up people who had gotten infected in the past and we didn't know about it. So it seemed like the rate was going even up higher. And then once that kind of equilibrated, then it went a little bit lower. So I'm thinking that that's really what he's seeing. But, you know, if it gives people a kind of a boost, that's fine. We just have to keep doing it. But the problem is that anything that we do is not going to have an immediate effect. We're in a time machine type of a thing where you do something and then you look around and it didn't help at all and it's not going to help, or you're not going to notice that it's going to help until 2 to 3 weeks later. So if you're always not giving it that 2 to 3 weeks, you never know what you're doing when you're doing it right or when you're doing it wrong, because if you do things terribly wrong, you won't notice the first few days either. So everything's on a couple of weeks delay, which is confounding human concepts of things. People like to have immediate responses to things. When it's delayed, they get confused and frightened, and they go off doing strange things.
Yeah, but he also mentioned, I think it was part of that was an example of Westchester, where it kind of first hit in New York, at least where we think it first hit. I guess that was, I don't have it quite clear, I think that was starting to slow down, or the rate of increase was starting to slow down or something. The other little question I have is, I play saxophone, clarinet, flute. These are things I put in my mouth. You know, like maybe it's no different than like putting a fork in my mouth when I eat food, like if I happen to touch it. That's kind of indirectly putting my fingers in my mouth. So it's, anyways, I guess I should just be cleaning those surfaces as well, the mouthpiece. Like in a case of a flute, it's just metal I'm putting against my mouth, this smooth, hard metal. Yeah, if you have any comment on that, back to you, Roy.
I think it's best to be cautious, unless, you know, people are relatively close to you and, relatively close to you where you put your equipment down. Then it's very possible that they could spray the area with their phlegm and spittle and such, and if you don't wipe down the mouthpiece, it can have virus particles. So, yeah, I would, you know, if you have it in your hands and not anywhere near anyone else, I don't think you have to repeatedly clean it and wipe it and such. But certainly if it's near someone else and, you know, within, say, 6 feet of any other person that you're not quite sure of, I would wipe it down.
Right now, of course, I'm not doing it around anybody else. No gigs. That's another issue with me, but I'm home safe, so I'm just practicing. So I'm just thinking more like indirect, like it's all my hands, and my hand touched the thing, goes in my mouth, but that's probably less and less, more and more diluted effect, just like I say, putting a fork in your mouth when you're eating your food, so maybe it's no different than that, what I'm talking about at home. Back to you, that's probably what it is.
Yeah, I mean, I would just focus on, you know, regular washing your hands. I mean, if absolutely no one comes into your house and no one drops off any packages and you're just kind of cocooned, then you don't have to be that fastidious about repeatedly washing your hands. But otherwise, you know, if you're picking up the mail, if you got a package from UPS, you know, if you're going out to pick up the newspaper or whatever, then probably it's a good idea to wash your hands after that. You got more problems from your hands touching things than dirty hands touching a mouthpiece, mouthpiece touching a mouth type of thing.
I'm washing my hands a little bit too much, but I guess that's, like you say, better too much than too little. And of course, like, my skin's getting quite dry, so if you did so much, your skin started chafing, and that would make you wash it, not enough in the future. I guess that would be the only concern with that. Anyway, I'll give it back to you, Roy, and for any other questions or going any of the net. Thanks, Roy. Thank you, everybody on the net. This is Bob Kitty 2NVB.
Welcome, Bob, and remember, there's always moisturizer. So once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. I am net control operator for this lovely little Kings County Radio Club technical net that meets on the second and fourth Wednesday of each month. If anyone has any further questions, topics, comments, statements to make before I shut her down for the night, please give me your call sign and your name. Well, this net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York. We usually meet on the first Wednesday of each month. Our next meeting will be April 1st, which will be held by teleconferencing. Club members will be emailed with the details on how to log into the meeting. Our regular general meeting starts at 8 p.m. and continues anywhere from 9 p.m. to 10 p.m., depending upon the number of points that are covered. We have a weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday at 9 p.m. on this repeater, as well as a 10-meter net every Sunday morning at 11 a.m. on 28.380 upper sideband. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month at 9 p.m. We have a weekly net featuring Yaesu Fusion Digital Technology every Thursday at 9 p.m. on our club repeater. If you can communicate using Fusion Technology, please join in. You can connect to our repeater while in Fusion Digital mode, either directly using a Fusion Digital Technology radio, or by using a hotspot and any other digital technology modes using our network gateways, such as our XLX server. We offer an audio stream of the FusionNet on the internet, as well as all audio transmissions of our club repeater at stream.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is available on our club website. If you would like to contact the host of the technical net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website services were generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, Three Aliens Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. We're living through some dangerous times, guys, recently, but trust me, we will persevere. We will get to the other end of this questionable tunnel of ours. Stay sane, stay mindful, follow medical advice, and we will all get through this. Well, it's time to roll this up and shut this down, but we'll be back to do it all over again on April 8th, and you're all welcome to join us here. Thanks to all the people that participated tonight, and especially to Jason, WF2N. Without you guys, I would just be talking to myself. So this is Roy, AC2GS, and I'll be going clear and getting the heck out of here. Stay safe, guys. Until next time.
Up, guys. Thank you. And for reissues, clear.
Keep up the good work.
Net, Roy. Good net. Thank you. AC2, AE, clear.
Guys, thank you. And for reissue, clear.
Alpha Charlie 2, Zulu Victor. Good night.